Welcome to Design Your Life, the podcast where we explore the central role design plays in our everyday lives, and how, if harnessed correctly, has the power to positively transform the way that we live, design better businesses, and sustainable solutions for the planet. We speak to creative entrepreneurs around the world about how they inspire their ideas to life, and how they make it all work, and the role design plays in their lives. I'm your host, founder of Frost Collective, and author of Design Your Life, Vince Frost. Welcome to today's episode of Design Your Life. Today I catch up with incredible creative duo, Louise Olsen and Stephen Ormandy, founders of Dinosaur Designs here in Sydney. Tune in as we chat about how they have managed their relationship as life and business partners over the past 40 years, and how art has always been in their lives, and how they have scaled their creative business from a market store in Paddington to 10 stores across the globe. Hey, Louise and Stephen, welcome to Design Your Life.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vince. Thanks for having us in.
Oh, it's so cool to have you here. Not far from your studio. We're just in Alexandra. You guys are in, is it Surrey Hills? What do you call it?
Redfern if you're buying. Surrey Hills if you're selling, maybe.
That's good. And obviously, you guys are incredibly well known. Known of you, seen you around for a long, long time, and huge fan of both of your work and what you've done together and what you've done individually as well. And we're going to talk about that today. You're a phenomenal couple, and you've been in business for
40 years.
40?
40 years.
Wow.
Next year, 40 years.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it freaks us out too, because I can't believe how quickly it's all gone.
Yeah, 40 years in business. We're 30 years this year, which I thought was a long time.
Oh, yeah. 30 years
is
a great milestone.
30 is a long time.
So clearly you don't retire at 40 then.
No.
Okay, I've got another 10 years left then.
Oh, at least. Vince, you're just warming up. Come on.
You both come from incredibly creative families, and Louise, your dad, John, sadly passed away a year ago.
Yeah, last April.
Yeah. Incredibly sad.
And 23, yeah.
I guess one of the most creative people in this country. I'd be really interested to understand how it was for both of you kind of growing up in both your creative families, and how that influenced you.
Oh, gosh. I mean, it influenced me immensely. I mean, from the moment I was born, I was the smell of turpentine and oil paint, and there was always a studio in the house. We lived in a small weatherboard cottage at Watson's Bay, mm-hmm. and it always had a studio. My dad had a studio in the living room, and we had a sort of little bedrooms next door, and my parents were upstairs, and my mum had another studio in the front room of the house. So I really was born right into the art world, so which I feel incredibly lucky and incredibly blessed, because I got to learn so much when I was so young.
And Stephen, similar for you too, right?
Yeah, my mum was a ceramicist, and she was the enabler of my creative addiction, which was wonderful. Mm. She backed just about everything I wanted to do. My go-to present for every birthday was a pad and texters. And the pad had to have no lines. It had to be just an empty space, not a colouring book. I would refuse to colour in colouring books. There just had to be your own ideas. And, yeah, my dad, he just basically stayed out of the way. Bless him.
Well, it's interesting that with some families that we talk to, or some guests that I've had on the podcast before, have come from, you know, families that are engineers or not seen in kind of the creative world, but they've kind of through their education and going to art school or finding their way, they finally found art. I kind of wonder what it's like. As a small child, we're naturally all born creative, right? We're all born
definitely
making marks and making messes and exploring and all that.
It's absolutely right. And I think every kid has that. It's a shame people stop. I was obsessed with being creative. Well, that was all I did. And at kindergarten, I decided I was going to be an artist. And that was my first art school. I used to take it seriously. I used to get my little smock ready, and then I was off to kindy on my three-wheeler. Back then, you know, Mum would wave goodbye at the gate and you'd ride your little three-wheeler around the corner to kindergarten. So things were a lot more relaxed.
Jesus. What, 3 years old?
Yeah, 3 years.
No. Well, oh. Not at kindergarten. You're older than three on my three-wheeler bike.
Oh, okay. All right.
You know, you're probably five. You know, kindergarten's five or six, I think.
So you already worked out your career by age three. You're driving at age three.
I was, riding.
Business plans.
Yep. Wow, that's 40 years. That's why we look so young. Been in business 40 years, Vince.
No, it's really interesting. I was kind of wondering if that gives you a head start, or how does that influence you in your kind of growing up of understanding, being, I guess, encouraged to continue to be creative through your whole life, not just from a small child. That fascinates me. I know we're going to maybe go a bit off topic, but I think that you guys have seemed to have lived your whole life in the world of creativity and continue to do so and explore all new kind of avenues of a creative outlet.
It's something that I've never really thought anything about. It's just who I am and how I go about everything.
I mean, I feel like it just gave me such a great head start. Because I was naturally had a feeling and an ability, and I was living in a world and grew up in a world where all my strengths lied. Mm. So I just felt like
that
I could
showed
just,
at art school.
I felt
Louise
like I could just
ahead.
Leap ahead.
You were ahead of the rest of us at art school.
Because I was at art school, because there was no childcare when I was a small child. It was, my parents were running an art school in a bakery in Paddington called The Bakery. And so after school, we'd go to the art school and often join in on the life drawing classes. And then my father was teaching or my mother was teaching. So from a very, very early age, I was learning to draw. But also, that they also celebrated children's drawings as well, like that whole sensibility, that sort of unexpected energy that children have, that innate, that sometimes gets trained out of children, which is so sad. Yeah. In so many ways, you know, a child has such a great inner understanding when they see a bird or a tree, and then when someone says to them, oh no, it doesn't look like a tree, or it doesn't look like a bird, but how about it feels like a bird, or it feels like a tree, and that's the difference. It's getting inside the subject.
You notice that even in design school. I've taught at some design schools sometimes over the years, and you can see that there's sometimes students can be uncomfortable or unconfident in what they're doing, and anyone makes a comment, they backtrack or they back down, which is incredibly sad, and that happens, I guess, in people's lives as well. But I kind of wonder if it's, you say that you're brought up in a creative environment and you're naturally talented in that regard. Is it a natural talent, or is it the exposure to that creativity or that constant thinking and doing the craft, etc.?
Maybe. I mean, it's certainly a drive. I was hopeless at school. I mean, I was terrible at mathematics. I failed, and you know, I wasn't a sort of high A student at school at all. And it was all the creative subjects that I really naturally excelled at. So
thank God for those.
Yeah, thank God. Thank God. It's only those subjects were taken more seriously in schools, though. That was a
shame. Art class was considered a bit of a bludge, which I think it was so disappointing. I'd get there and I'd be all, you know, game on. This is serious, and everyone else is like yippee, and I'd think, no, come on, we work. This is really exciting what we can do here.
Because when you think of so many subjects, even mathematics, they're very creative subjects.
Creativity underlines.
And it's creative thinking that sets us apart.
Yeah.
That breeds new ideas, and that's what's so important.
Yeah, absolutely. This,
and that they need. I hope in our education system that becomes more serious.
Yeah.
Because that's what really sets us apart.
Yeah, I think it's starting to be valued a lot more. Creativity and the power that it can bring to an organization.
I did a talk the other day talking about education to a school in Melbourne, to all the 70 of the teachers there around design thinking and designing your life. And I was quite intimidated, to be honest, because it was, you know, I was always scared of school. And now talking to teachers about design feels really strange. But they were really, they felt really kind of inspired by it and empowered by how they could might use a different way of thinking or a creative way of thinking to problem solve, as opposed to what they learned traditionally, kind of academically.
Because we all have a different way of thinking around the subject. Just the way we, when we write something, I'll write in my writing and you'll write in your writing, but they'll look completely different.
Yeah.
And it's the same as the way we think, you know, and how we expose ourselves creatively, that we all have a different way of seeing the world.
Yeah, we really do. And you guys met on the first day of art school. Do you call it art school?
Yeah.
Design
it,
school?
It was an art school.
Art school?
Yeah, we didn't go to design school. How did we get to
How did you get from being kids to the bakery, et cetera, to...
That's just running the gauntlet through school. That's just, the worst years of your life, I think, is the education system. It's brutal.
Yeah.
You know, not only in the way they teach the students, the process, it's hard work going to school.
Socially too.
Oh, everything about it's brutal. It's but that's kind of life, so get used to it, buttercup.
Yeah, but I hated that kind of sit down, shut up, you know, follow instructions.
Yeah.
And rote learning, I think, is pretty boring.
Yeah.
I couldn't really apply myself to it. That process of regurgitating rather than thinking about a subject. They're the subjects I did well at when you actually had to think about it.
I went through a period where I went to a Steiner school for a while. Yeah. So I went to a Vaucluse public school and then went to a Steiner school and then went to a girls' school after that. So I kind of had the taste of all different styles of education. But I found the Steiner school was amazing because it was such a creative spirit that ran through.
Yeah, and luckily I went to a Steiner school for my final 2 years of schooling because I was done. I wanted to go to tech.
Was this still kindergarten?
No. This is senior school, man. I've moved on. I've been at school, and, you know, just trying to fight my way through it. And then I wanted to go to tech, but my mother found a school she felt was going to be more creative than where I'd been, and that was Glen Ian. So that was a great experience for me. And they were embracive of, you know, the whole place was about creativity.
Yeah.
A wonderful education system.
My kids went to school at Montessori and Bondi, and it was just so wonderful to see them learning by playing. And I really wish there was a high school version of that. I think there probably is, but not nearby.
Well, the kids still today, I know friends have their young kids at this school and they come back filthy. It's the best, like...
And exhilarated.
Bush dirt. Yeah. You know, they've been out crawling through the bush, doing all sorts of playing games. Yeah, really, really good stuff.
And it's interesting too because we're all kids at heart, aren't we? And we're still, you know, inquisitive, playful, questioning.
So important. That's one thing I love about my father. He passed away when he was 95, but he was still such a big kid. I love that so much about him.
Well, that's interesting too around when you go through school, and we'll get to your career shortly, but when you go through school and all that, it's all about learning, kind of, you know, doing what you got to do to get the grades. And then often people think that once they've done the learning, this finished school or their high school or university, that they're done, that the learning doesn't continue. But it doesn't, does it?
Like, no, it's just the
beginning. You're just beginning.
Yeah, it teaches you to be a student of life. Yeah. And that's people that you inevitably find successful, they never stop learning. They never stop thinking about learning. And that's the way we approach everything. There's always something exciting to learn about.
That's right. There's so much discovery in the making. And when you start making and creating, you're always discovering, aren't you?
Yeah.
Go, oh, what about that? Oh, we could be doing this. So many possibilities.
So talk about how you guys discovered each other, because that's a good segue.
Was
it love at first sight?
Yep.
For you, it was.
Yeah.
Don't pause, Louise.
Well, you didn't give her a chance. I mean, she was about to jump in.
I'm letting you finish.
She's very polite.
I'm letting you finish.
No, it was. We were, well, call it what you like. We were highly attracted to one another.
Yeah.
So on the very first day we met. And we had a lovely conversation. We've been best friends ever since.
That's awesome. Yeah. And what were you studying? We both studying the same thing?
Yeah, it was a painting class. So, you know, the first day we didn't have equipment. So the teacher said, well, let's go down to the art gallery and talk about artworks. So we were all walking around, bumping around, talking to one another, looking at artworks. And I'm standing in front of five bells, and Louise walks up and says, "See that mark just there? I did that." I said, "What?" She said, "Yeah, my dad painted that."
Ah. See, what happened was because
that was a brag,
studio was right next to the bedrooms, and sometimes at night Tim and I would, my brother and I would wake up and we'd
graffiti.
Sometimes we'd get the brushes and do a little mark on his paintings.
Really?
And one time, I mean, sometimes he would paint our hands and we'd put a little hand mark on his paintings. But sometimes it was, you know, sometimes go, "By Christ, what have you kids been doing in the middle of the night?"
Did you get in trouble?
Sort of, yeah, we did.
So secretly,
lucky with oil paint, you can kind of rub it out.
Yeah. Some of his best work was actually your work.
We did a few little touches.
Those touches made him.
Just little touches. Yeah.
He didn't own up about that. I remember coming to Australia, you know, maybe 30 years ago, moving here 20 years ago. But each time I came, I think like 20 years ago, first time I saw Dinosaur Designs in Oxford Street in Paddington, I was just blown away by the brand itself. The Dinosaur Designs is a name and a brand, and then obviously the products as well. Fantastic. But how did you get from painting classes at art school meeting to where you are today? How did you start the brand?
I put it down to Louise.
Oh, thank you. But no, look, I knew when you leave art school, there really isn't much job opportunities. So I felt like we needed to create something.
Qualified for zero jobs.
Yeah. Back to waitressing, back to washing dishes in restaurants.
Yeah, jobs related too. Yeah. Because your job is to be on your own in a studio creating artwork.
Yeah. And I felt that with our abilities that we could create something. And make something that could be sort of tangible that people would want to buy.
And individually, we had all been doing that anyway. I was already making jewellery. I was making earrings and selling them to a local store, Cash Palace. So I'd make 10 pairs a week and that'd give me $100.
Yeah.
And that's what I needed.
And doing that sort of thing, selling it to different designers. And Leanne Rossler at the time was also with us, and she was knitting, making beautiful knitted jumpers and cardigans.
And selling them. So we're all individually doing these more immediate things, creative, but still an opportunity to sell, you know, smaller objects. And so we just came together and thought, well, let's go to the markets. It's a good place to, you know, set up a stall. And back then, getting into Paddington markets was hard work. You had to get there at 5 a.m. to get in the queue. To then, when they opened at 6, put your name down to potentially get a stall. And the first couple of weeks, we didn't even get a stall.
Wow.
Because it was so popular and so difficult to get into. So it took a bit of persistence. Even just to get a market stall was hard work.
But it was a great experimenting point for us because we were exploring all sorts of things, printing T-shirts, making dresses.
Yeah, and we thought, how hard can it be? We found out very difficult to make a garment. And some of these things were very sock-like. And we had one dress, went off to the change rooms and she didn't come back. And we thought, oh, she's just taken it. Anyway, she came back and threw it down and said, "I've been stuck in that dressing room for half an hour trying to get this damn thing off."
Fantastic. Jeez.
So our fashion design skills were lacking.
But the print was great. The print was good.
Have you still got it?
I think probably in a box somewhere.
I heard somewhere in the archive.
Yeah, those things did not sell well.
But it's interesting because I guess from afar, like most people would experience you guys and your brand, et cetera, and your individual brands after that, it looked like you'd done the shop, the brand, the jewellery and the, what do you call it, polymers?
Yeah.
Or the, how do you call
resin.
It?
Resin.
The resin, the beautiful resin. Yeah, the jewellery, but also the vessels and all that. It looked like you'd kind of done that, got that established, and then you went off to do your own personal painting. But it sounds like you were always doing all that all along.
Yeah, that was always in the background. Dinosaur really engulfed our world and we love doing it and continue to love doing it. It took a lot of effort, but it was so much great reward and we you know, had such a creative outlet. We loved it. So
it was but quite in the liberating background. In a way, wasn't it? Because we were able to take it to so many different places, open stores, and there's a lot of accessibility about being in the design world as opposed to being an artist and being alone in your studio. So there's being young, you know, quite young at that time, and meeting many different people, going to all sorts of different shows, getting our designs out there into fashion shows as well as interior design shows. It was a lot of fun,
yeah,
and a lot of accessibility in that, and being able to take it to New York and London and all those places around the world. It was incredible exposure very quickly.
I agree. We'll talk more about the artwork. Art world too. How did you go from the? Did you go? Is it naturally you went from the stall, the market stall, to the shop because you got?
No, like, we had a little bit of wholesale in the meantime. We I'd sold previously to a little store called Cash Palace, mm-hmm. Elaine Townsend, and she came up, heard I was up to something up at the markets, and turned up and saw what we were doing. And by then we'd moved the clothing on and we're just focusing on the accessories, which we were hand painting sculpted Fimo. So it was a lovely little release. They were like our little paintings. I was doing little abstracts. There were, you know, motifs from, you know, the history of art, all sorts of crazy things. So we're painting the Fimo, and we were doing quite well, actually. We actually started to earn a little bit of money, which kind of was good.
Yeah. And then we had enough money to go to London, and we were invited to be part of an exhibition of Australian design with Jane de Teliger. And it was an exhibition that was at the Victorian Museum in London.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, all sorts of things were happening with us as far as designing pieces of jewellery for Kylie Minogue and for INXS and all the
music. Yeah, things had moved on quite a bit.
Things had moved on quite quickly. And that accessibility, again, was opening up even more. So that and during that time, which was around 89, we opened our first store in the Strand Arcade.
But you missed the important bit, the Fashion Design Council parades,
yes,
that we did in Melbourne.
That's right.
On the back of our wholesaling, we got invited to be part of that. And we were creating these hand-painted jewellery pieces. And we decided, rather than just hang little earrings on a model, let's paint massive versions, make them out of cardboard, paint these paintings, and send the models down the catwalk wearing literally a massive version of the jewellery.
That's neat.
And it was mad as crazy stuff. But this whole parade, it just, within this parade, it made sense because everyone was doing the most wacky, outrageous creations. It was so much fun. And the buyer at George's noticed, clearly could not notice us, and contacted us and said, I want the collection for George's in Melbourne. And that being, you know, Australia's premier store was just wonderful for us. It really kicked us off, you know. People were starting to ring up and wanting to buy, and we were wholesaling quite well. So then we moved on to, as Louisa's point, went to that exhibition in London. And when we went away, we said to all our accounts, please pay our bills, you know, otherwise we'll go bankrupt, you know, whilst we're away.
Yeah.
And we got back and none of them have paid.
Oh.
Not, and, you know, back then communication was expensive. We're not going to ring. We're kind of backpacking around Europe. It was, you know, the late 80s, so it wasn't like it is today. So we thought, we need to be independent because we were already selling to our friends quite well, and things that they were buying, the shops weren't buying. So we thought, let's open a shop in the Strand Arcade, great little location for us, tiny shop. So we opened that and, yeah, just took off for us. It was fantastic.
Fantastic. How did you manage that, go from, you know, because not all creatives are good at business, are they?
Just did it.
Yeah, I think instinctively. I mean, we're a small business, and I think this is the beauty of having a small business. You're always going to make mistakes, mm-hmm. and you learn from them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at least the mistakes are small and you can handle them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. One's good, two's checking, three's an idiot.
So it took off from there? And now you've got like 9 stores, plus you've got New York and London as well.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then we wholesale around the world.
And people would say, gee, you're an overnight success. And I say, yeah, 10 years. It's a long overnight.
And how did you feel then when you, I guess that wasn't your first time that you would have gone to the UK and to Europe, but how did you feel as creative people in Europe or London, etc.?
It was kind of lovely traveling with a purpose, rather than just backpacking and seeing and viewing, actually turning up and having appointments and meeting buyers. It just added to the whole process. Really enjoyable. You know, getting into a showroom in New York in 89 on their way to the V&A, and this lady was looking at one of our necklaces, and all of a sudden we hear this massive crash and she smacked it onto the table and then's looking at all the beads to see if they would break. Like, that's New York for you.
Oh,
they
my
just,
God.
New York's so tough. But you learn so much, and it just really was an exciting...
It was, and you know, we're young designers, and being Australian, we don't know the rules, so all of a sudden, people say, oh, Barney's is a great store, and I think, well, I'll give them a call, show our collection. So I ring Barney's and say, can I speak to the accessory buyer? And I get put through, and I have a little chat, and I said, yeah, we're on our way to exhibit at the V&A, and just wondering if you'd like to see our collection. She said, sure, bring it up tomorrow. Wow. So we did, and, you know, like things... crazy stuff. And I'd tell other people and they'd say, what, you got onto the buyer at Barney's? I go, yeah, I just gave her a call.
Yeah.
Where if I'd spoken to them first, I may never have bothered.
I think there's an Australian boldness that we had at that time.
Just give them but back then you just gave everyone a ring. That's all you could do. There was no fax. There was no texting. There was just the phone calls were it.
I guess there was very few creatives going the other way like you were, like at that time. Like, there's a lot of creatives coming this way. I don't know if you feel this, but I feel like Australia has changed dramatically in the 20 years I've been here.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of elevation or the understanding of creativity and the diversity that's happening, kind of homegrown.
Yeah, and I think also the world realizing that Australia has something to contribute. You know, it's not just to be pushed aside as if, you know, some backwater. That some really interesting things are happening here.
I think also it's a lot more accessible for a lot of young designers now, too, that we are people of the world now. We're not so isolated.
Yeah.
The way we communicate and the way we're able to travel is very different than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing, yeah. You know, we were a backwater back then because it's so far to come.
Mm.
Two plane flights, that's one too many for most people. In Europe and the US.
How did you know what you're doing was going to be commercially successful, or did you
no
know?
No idea.
No, we just sort of had this belief in it and just followed our hearts with it, really.
But we didn't have some grand plan as well to, you know, end up with 10 stores and one in New York and one in London. That was...
It was always about the design for us. And
it was about what we were
doing. And what we were creating. And then I think everything kind of looks after itself in a way, really. Yeah. I think you've just really got to hone in on what you're doing, what you're creating.
Single most important thing. What's your marketing success? Doing good work.
Yeah. And then things sort of take care of themselves after that. Things start to open up for you. The calls seem to be happening about one particular design or one particular work. So it just, I think the most important thing is really focus on what you're doing, what you're creating, and really play with it and have fun with it, you know.
Do you think it helps? We're from the generation before the internet. I think I am, but I don't know. Yeah, oh, you guys might be. Absolutely. Social media and everything, like, you just look at it all the time now. It's just bang, 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 stuff from all over the place, whether it's real or not or whatever. Do you feel like it was might have been easier back then when there was less distractions? Just kind of just focus on what you have to do?
In some ways, it was easier, but other ways it was harder because I think technology stood in your way, especially, say, you're a young band and you want to record a song. Back then, virtually impossible to get anything of any quality outside of spending a lot of money.
We could do a song right now.
We could.
With this $1,000 equipment.
The setup is incredible. So tech, you know...
Let's do it.
you buy a Mac, you've got...
No.
You get software that's good enough. You know, Billie Eilish releases a record from a bedroom with a brother.
Yeah.
that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, yeah.
What hasn't shifted is the need for quality. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone can get in a bedroom now, so the tech doesn't hold you back. But what holds you back is the quality of your ideas. Mm-hmm. That's everything. It always has been everything, but I think a lot of ideas back then never got out because a lot of good stuff didn't get released because of the filtration system.
It
was very tight then, wasn't
who was
it?
Deciding who spent the money exactly. on what. There were all these filters holding people back.
That's like, back then it was magazines and books, and there's someone curating that content, someone just making a decision of what's in, what's not in.
And
there.
These people were incredibly powerful, and they kind of knew it too. Mm. So now that, you know, all that's kind of being wiped away.
There's this vastness now, isn't there?
People can shoot a movie. Yeah, people can shoot a movie on an iPhone now.
Yeah.
The quality's phenomenal.
Or not even do that. They can do it with AI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like make a whole feature film with AI.
Exactly. So, but if the idea is no good.
No, true.
Doesn't work.
Have you guys, you've been together a long time, happily married. You've raised a family with Camille, your daughter, who's also an incredibly creative person too. And you run the business and you're doing your art and you're doing all these things. It's very unusual, I think. I've had a few attempts, but it's something which is, you know, like hats off to you guys around making that work. Is your relationship like just naturally cool like that, or is it a creative endeavor in itself? You know,
I think it's what you said. It's a creative endeavor within itself in a way. I mean, we've had this sort of long conversation. We share enormous interests together. And we go on wonderful journeys together, and somehow we've got this sort of push and pull, lovely kind of dynamic with each other, I guess.
You know, but it's not as if we work at, you know, the whole working at it.
Thing. No, it just flows. It's kind of natural. I mean, we give each other space when we need space, and we concentrate on our work and. We share our work, but then work independently.
Yeah, and we understand if, you know, Louise needs to work in the studio, she needs to work in the studio. The same with me, you know, I've got a deadline, I've got to be, I won't be going to that, I won't be doing that.
I guess we have a
and
good understanding.
We don't get upset with each other on those issues.
We have a good understanding, I think, with each other.
Yeah.
Do you feel content, or do you feel always hungry for... new, not the relationship, I mean the work
I
and
think
the creativity.
So. Yeah, the work, and you get into a headspace where you're constantly thinking of progression, you know, because being an artist is developing a visual language.
Mm.
And that, like all language, needs to be alive, needs to be learning, needs to be growing. That's what we do. We're constantly thinking of new ideas, how we can go about, where, you know...
We're like explorers.
Where we've been and...
Yeah.
Yeah, using that to keep moving forward.
And it's the same with relationships. You have to keep pushing and keep exploring and keep opening up and keep, you're on a journey together. And it's the same with your creative journey.
If you share similar goals, it's very helpful because you're not pushing or pulling against one another too much. There's not friction. We have we like to achieve the same things.
Yeah, and I guess we've always had a lot of drive and a lot of, even when we were younger, a lot of ambition.
Mm. Do you ever get, I don't know, some people talk about imposter syndrome or that feeling, like sometimes I get, I've been designing for 40 years plus now, but there are days I'm sitting here thinking, fuck, have I still got it, you know?
There's,
I don't know, do you ever have those bad days?
Self-doubt, are you kidding?
Okay, absolutely. Good.
It sits on your lap every day.
Okay,
it's
good.
With you.
Oh, not good.
It's with you for every
God,
work.
Yes.
That's reassuring.
One of my favourite sayings is don't believe your own press. Just don't. It's good, it's beautiful, but it's one side of the story. And
exactly.
You know, life's like synchronised swimming. It's all good above water, but underneath those legs are kicking like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So what is it that... Because I'm constantly thinking, like, what is it? Is it something I ate? Is it lack of sleep? Is it that something I'm working on is not right for me? Is it the full moon? There's all kinds of stuff. So I'm
sometimes
thinking about.
You just need to be a bit chilled with yourself too, where you just need to have a bit of dream time.
Yeah.
You need to go and smell the roses and hug
the
trees.
Or as your dad would call it, billabong time.
A billabong time.
You know, you've been in the big river, in the big boat, paddling like crazy. Now and again, you need to just step off and get in the billabong.
It's
and
interesting.
Have a rest.
You wouldn't think that you get people. I guess people wouldn't. Some people who aren't doing it for a living maybe think it's we get paid to play. So it doesn't. It looks easy. It looks fun, you know.
Yeah,
but it
yeah.
actually is pretty. It can be pretty intense, can't it?
Oh God, yeah. I mean,
and you're
in,
it.
Yeah, I mean, we've been in very tricky situations sometimes, and with what we've been doing, and just wondering how. Oh my God, how are we going to get through this one? And
yeah, just keep going.
And, but also, as you say, in a studio situation too, where you go through a run, and you're saying, "What the hell am I doing? Nothing is working."
Yeah.
All these paintings just aren't coming together.
There's I guess with all the shops as well, have you got to keep coming up with new ideas or seasonal work?
I mean, I find ideas look after themselves in many ways. I find that one idea, like one collection, leads to another collection. You can't. I mean, sometimes you get a little bit of writer's block and think, oh God, where do we go next? But I generally find that one thing leads to another. Do you find that, Vince?
The continuity?
Yeah, the continuity. Do you find that with your work?
But I've gone I guess it's okay if it's your brand, but if you're doing the same thing for everybody, for other brands, then you feel like, hang on, I've got something similar going through all of the work.
Yeah.
Mm.
Where really, I guess the work that we do is more kind of, I guess, from other people's brands, other people's, helping other people be successful. It's like, how much of yourself do you put into it? We put our heart and souls into it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But it's not, well, I guess, it's personal projects are different to the more commercial projects, I guess.
Yeah, your experience is different in that you're working to achieve something for someone else.
Yeah.
And quite often they want to have an idea and an input into that process where we need to just satisfy ourselves.
Yeah.
Mm. We don't have anyone putting any input.
And no one critiques it.
Well, it's
the customer.
The customer critiques, you know, you can sit on the shelf and there's a whole lot of them back in the studio and they're not selling. That's critique right there.
but we also critique each other too.
And we constantly, show each other our work, what we're doing, and we're brutal. If we're not into it, we don't beat around the bush, never have.
Well, sometimes you have to be a bit delicate.
You're both brutal. I can see.
But even being delicate is brutal. Don't even the slightest non-positive, even a hand on a hip is taken as what?
What's that twitch?
What are you talking about? And inevitably, we will say, "How very dare you?" And then half an hour later, you're sitting in your chair looking at it going, "Oh, God,
she's right.
Oh
man, do you tally those things up in your head?
You know,
I'm gonna have a couple of wins. Now
no,
it's my turn.
I think if you're talking about hanging, just we don't hang on to stuff. Let it go.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think that's been a really good thing in our work environment too.
You can't
hang on
to
stuff.
To have
people around you that don't hang on and get mooed out for and not talk to you for a long time. You need to get through stuff because you're dealing with volatile situations, and all sorts of work dynamics and people. And so you need to get through things quickly and move on.
And don't bring that baggage into the next meeting or the next, sometimes, we need to walk around the block or something like that, but just breathe it out.
Okay, what taught you that?
Oh, maybe that's...
Humans.
Natural, I don't know. Maybe
creativity is a lot about feeling, isn't it?
It is.
Feelings is a huge part of being a creative person, or heightened feelings. Like it's hard to manage that. I think.
Yeah, I guess it's a mixture of learning and letting go as well.
Yeah.
Amish Kapoor talked about failing, and I think it's one of the great quotes is, "I need a quick fail." A long, languid fail is no fun. That's if it's not working, you need to be swift and don't hang on and move on.
Mm. Something that used to bother me a lot was this kind of aiming for perfection, trying to get it 100% right or as best it possibly can be. Sometimes that I learned over time that became quite intimidating.
Mm.
And it is better to put things down quickly and try stuff and see what comes out of that.
Mm.
But do you, how focused are you guys on perfection? Like,
I mean, our pieces are quite wabi-sabi in a way, because we're working with a relatively modern material, which is resin.
Mm-hmm.
But our signature in a way was that we love working with it in a very hand-felt way.
Yeah.
And we wanted it to be very tactile and in its nature, very kind of natural and organic in its form.
I've got to tell you something very funny. I was... just thought of this. I was in a shop in Avalon, we won't say what it is, and what piece of your, a vase, I think, was there.
Yeah.
And someone came in and said, oh my God, is this made from dinosaur bones? Have you had that before?
Well, we have.
We've had some strange.
Oh, I was like,
we've had some funny ones in New York.
Yeah, is this some sort of indigenous craft? I thought it was one of the.
Is this aboriginality or something?
Oh. No, they said arabiginal.
Oh my God.
Which was such a strange pronunciation.
That is weird.
And we're just looking, blinking, going, oh, right, okay, welcome to New York.
And this international success you've had and success you've had in the UK and in America, how does your brand resonate? I mean, who is it the same type of, is it more creative people that kind of buy into your product?
Yeah, I mean, it's very varied. I mean, we've been in New York now for, gosh, how many years now? We started when actually, we signed the lease just before 9/11, actually.
Yeah, so it was just 2000 we started that program with the, you know, lawyers and all of that. And then, it was dragged on, and then September 11 happened, which was terrible.
That was a scary. And we were in the exclusion zone, and the store was being...
We just inked the lease, and we were ready to get a builder in, and,
And we couldn't get any glass for the front window. So, sorry, that
it was kind of a frantic time to open your
first
store.
You need glass in a front window in New York.
Everyone else downtown needed glass because all their glass had been totally blasted.
And we'd already spent a fortune on this process, and suddenly New York blew up. It was terrible time, and for us, it's a minor whinge from us from what happened to the Americans.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's horrific.
But, we persevered and to the good spirits of New York, it bounced back and we prospered from it all.
Yeah, so now and over 22 years?
Yeah.
Nearly 23.
And I guess COVID hit you too, right? You had all COVID these stores during COVID, must have been tricky.
Yeah, in London as well. So
it's really hard work. Plus, we got in New York, we got fire above. And they put through a swimming pool of water that basically then went through our shop. So that just destroyed. And then we got looted on top of all of that. So that was a pretty wild time to have a business in New York.
Ouch.
Yeah.
But we rebuilt and we're back on.
Insurance paid and it all went quite well. So, in the end, it's again a minor whinge compared to what other people had to go through.
I'm doing a talk at UNSW tomorrow. It's kind of creative conversations, and it's about scaling creative businesses. And it's interesting. It is interesting conversation because I'd love to have had you guys on it, but you weren't available, sadly. But at least we got you in the podcast, which is more important for me. but the idea of scaling a business, as a creative person, a lot it's at a university, at design school, and there's people on courses thinking about their career or working on a career or a craft or whatever it might be, with the view that they are going to go either work for somebody or kind of do their own thing. And the idea of, it sounds like you guys never worked for anybody.
No. I've never had a job.
No.
Oh, I have, but yeah.
Yeah, you worked in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a little bit, but... No, I've never actually been... I've worked a day here and there for other people, but I've never actually had a job.
But
just kind of growing a... knowing what to grow or knowing what's to grow, what's right for you, Like, you guys have done phenomenally well and continue to do so. I know Shelley at Simpson, she's got, I think, similar number of stores around the world. That focusing on kind of finding your craft, your product, your brand, building a team around that to deliver that, because that's building a team really is a phenomenal thing to
employing people navigate. And getting people on board with your ideas. And there's such a huge leap, isn't it,
especially for people who were shit at school.
Yeah, exactly. You're so vulnerable.
Yeah.
You really are.
Well, it's kind of weird, isn't it?
No, I think we just when you dive into the pool, you either sink or you swim, and we've just kept swimming. I think that's the way to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, you start off with
you learn the lessons, and you employ one person, and then you know you have someone that doesn't work out, and you think, well, what went wrong with that space? And then you start to just become better and better at recognizing people that will fit with what you're doing.
So it grew very organically
and continues.
And continues now. Yeah. We have about 120.
Yep.
That's crazy. It is crazy.
But you clearly would have got key people in that made a big difference to them.
It really helped. Yeah,
good bookkeepers and good accountants. And
And
just
a GM.
Having a good team and really a great looks after. We have a great GM. And so it looks after us.
Are you there every day? Do you go into your studio every day?
Pretty much. We have a day in the studio, in our own studios, and then a couple of days at Dino, like 3 or 4 days at Dino. So we kind of divide it. We're always working.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like work.
No.
But you don't have to be out of space to work anymore. That's the other great thing about the modern world. You wake up in the morning, you look at your phone. That's like stepping into the office.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, there's a list on the front screen of, you know, emails that have come in overnight. You're off and running already. Answering, dealing with that, check that, you know, I'll follow up on that. You know, it's not like the old days where you get in, fire up the old IBM and watch, you know, wait for it forever to start.
Yeah.
But there's also that balance too about being there as well. I think you have to, it's important, we find with our business, that being there.
Crucial.
And being with your team and not being too removed.
Yeah, those conversations you have with someone as they step into the lift. As you're going upstairs, or you run into them at the front or down at the coffee shop, and you walk back and you have a chat about something that's come up for them.
Yeah,
you know, all those interactions are crucial, and they don't happen when you work from home.
Well, it's really cool. So you kind of created a community, and also a place for others to play, which is really cool.
Yeah, we like to support people that are starting their own business as well. So if someone comes in and says, I'm endeavouring to build this, we'll see that as a positive. And we want them to be successful in their business because they will be successful when they're working for us. Mm. And they will understand what it takes to do what we do. And we want to teach them how and what we've learned. And we're not a closed shop in that space. We're very open. And a lot of our people actually have their own businesses up and running, which we encourage that.
Oh, that's really cool.
So they work for us for a few days a week and then go to their businesses.
We get the best of them.
Yeah. As long as it's not the same product.
And they're motivated.
Exactly.
We have had
a few resin makers come in and work. Yeah. Which has been fine because we all do our own thing.
We're not that fast. It's just another material.
When we were younger, we used to be a lot more fussed about it when we got copied and ripped off.
You know, it'd be like Shelley not letting a potter come in and work for her. Of course she'll get a potter. She wouldn't even blink. She'd probably encourage that.
Yeah.
Because there's already a love and a passion there because they love being in
and
there.
And an understanding.
And they love design and they love, you know, they're discovering too.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, that's cool. And it's that energy, that young energy that's kind of coming through that you need to in your business.
Exactly, Vince.
Talk about, were you running the business for a number of years and then started to do more your art, or were you doing it on the side, or have you kind of created a business that gives you security to feel, to be able to put more time into your own personal art practice?
Yeah, definitely. And once you start exhibiting as an artist, that's when you really start to kick in. And you become part of a gallery and you're on their cycle. So, you know, you're showing every 2 years at Olsen and then you pick up another gallery, like I've picked up galleries overseas. So now I'm doing around two shows every year and that takes a lot of effort.
But we're both doing shows a year now, every 2 years. But we're actually doing one as a family in Paris this year.
Oh, wow.
In September. So
like it's a duo or three of you.
The three of us. Yeah. It's very exciting.
So it's our daughter Camille, who's finished National Art School last year.
Yeah.
And Stephen and myself at this beautiful gallery just outside of Paris.
Gallery Braceres, which is on the island of the Impressionists, which is in Chateau.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's where Renoir painted his famous painting, The Luncheon Party.
Wow. Yeah.
And there's actually
the restaurant's
painting there, and the restaurant's like still there. The Luncheon Party.
Wow.
So it's lovely. We've had some lovely lunches there.
Yeah. And that's where I've had a couple of shows with this gallery, and the director suggested that we have a family show, and we all just absolutely.
Wow. Yes, let's do it.
Yeah.
So it's going to be fun.
Watching you both from afar on Instagram, and you guys post a lot, and it's highly attractive and visual, and, you know. I noticed, obviously, Louise, you spent a lot of time with your dad over the last, 3 years, 5 years?
About 7 years.
Oh, was it?
7 or 8 years now.
Could it shifted more to you spending time? Looked like you were spending a lot of time with him and painting?
I was spending a lot of time with him, and he gave me a studio on the property. So he was, and I was also looking after him,
mm-hmm.
Because as he's getting older, it was getting difficult for him to walk, and he had a walking frame, and life was, he was getting older, it was getting difficult. And so I really felt an enormous calling to go and look after him.
Mm-hmm.
So I would leave the studio on Friday and then come back Tuesday and spend a good 4 days sort of looking after him.
Mm-hmm.
But having the studio down there was just fantastic. And meeting up and just learning even more from him, and just his having that time and that history of time with him, and the poetry. He was passionate about poetry and things that he was reading. I really treasure that time. And also discussing, we worked in separate studios, although during COVID we were actually doing Zoom groups where we were all had a group of friends, and we'd meet up on Zoom and pick up a fish or a bunch of flowers and all draw together on Zoom.
Yeah, Louise was down in the country for quite some time, I remember.
Yeah,
COVID was very surreal for all of us, wasn't it?
It was. We were doing life drawing groups and when COVID wasn't on, but we'd get a model in and get some friends around and draw. And so it was a lovely creative hub there, and great to spend time in the studio with Dad and also in my own studio.
Mm. How do you both find your own voice in your art? Does it come naturally?
You have to just start thinking about it, and that's the key. And then it will come.
I think just keep working. I mean, it was really important for me personally not to do work like my father, because I've always compared, your work looks a lot like, your father, particularly when I was younger, or any connection that people are always sometimes searching for the elements of both my parents and my work.
Mm-hmm.
And for me it was important that I found my own identity, and also being in the design world was completely liberating, because I was in a completely different world from the art world.
Yeah. It's interesting that, because kind of talking about like what we do here is, I guess, commercial art, commercial creativity. And I've often talked to people about that. That's like, some people think that's art. It's not art. It is creativity.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But when does it become art, and how do you make that change? I often, during COVID especially, I was sitting at my place down at Clareville just thinking, okay, I might do some art, but what do I do? It's not like with a commercial brief. You've got someone who contacts you, hey, I want you to do something, I'm going to pay you X amount, I need it by this date, and you do it.
Mm,
whereas art, for me, I was like going, okay, do I do a typographic poster? Hand render type on a poster, like on an oil canvas.
Only
like,
you can answer that question.
Well, I can't answer. That's the problem.
Yeah.
You can. And
oh,
you,
really?
Yeah, you can, because it's all about drive. If you have to do it, you have to do it, and you'll make that decision, and you'll put a piece of charcoal on a page, and that will be the beginning of that.
Okay. But that's where drawing is so good, Vince. I find that
it all comes out of drawing.
Yeah, it really does. If you start drawing and drawing a still life, or doing some life drawing, or I think there's so much in the opening of drawing. Drawing really opens you up.
And do you draw like all your jewellery as well, and your resin? Do you draw that?
Yeah, we're always sketching ideas.
Charcoal.
Because if you can have an idea and actually render it onto a page, pretty much as you're thinking about it, that's so crucial, because then that's a note, because you'll forget that. You'll forget that thought or that idea, but there it is in your book, and you go back and go, oh, that's That's right. Yeah, I was working on that.
Yeah, the little sketchbooks are really
important. Sketchbook is really good, especially when you have ideas and you write notes and
backs of envelopes and bits of paper.
No, I do it all the time. But it feels like a younger generation is maybe not doing it as much because of the technology.
Yeah, I agree. I worry about that because I don't think they're writing as much either.
No.
And I think there's something about the hand to brain that just we don't want to lose that. It's a lot of creativity, really.
And life
thrives
drawing,
in that realm.
Life drawing is crucial.
Yes.
To continue to draw the model, even though it's, you know, it's nothing to do with my visual language that I show, I think the ability to draw...
But it opens the eye up also.
You
realise how blind we really are when you start to draw. And when you really start to study a still life
proportion
or a model, you really realise, oh my gosh, I haven't really been seeing very much.
Mm.
And that's what's so wonderful about drawing too, is how much you realise about yourself and the way you're seeing.
In your art, do you get that same feeling? Do you look for that feeling... Or you're expressing yourself, but do you get a feeling that it's right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think you kind of get in the zone, don't you? Do you find sometimes when you're working out on an idea and then all of a sudden it just comes flooding at you?
Yeah, you kind of get into the zone. Yeah.
My dad used to describe it as that the friends on the other side come and visit you. I mean, he wasn't a religious or spiritual person. He was a spiritual person, but not a religious person. And he'd always say, you know, it's like the friends on the other side come and visit you and kind of take you over and you sort of enter into this realm, don't you?
It's creativity. A very addictive feeling.
It is.
Yeah,
it's
feels
incredible.
Good.
You know when you're
happy.
There too.
Yeah, when you're happy
just
with
start
things
coming together.
They really do, and you groove on it. It's fantastic.
And the intuition, I guess, intuition plays a big part in what you do as well.
Can do.
The instincts.
Instincts, intuition, just following the vibe that you're excited by.
And that's also understanding your vocabulary, because I think being able to draw opens up your vocabulary. So you've got this incredible access to your work.
And expressing an idea.
In your subconscious. And you know, when you think of artists like Jackson Pollock or Roscoe, they're all great drafts people.
Yeah, Pollock, amazing draftsman. People don't realise that about
them. They don't realise that, but then it really gave their work incredible liberty and freedom.
And de Kooning, yeah, amazing draft.
Although it looks, you know, may look chaotic to you, but in fact it's not.
That sophistication that you get when you look at their work comes through their training. And we were part of our generation going through art school. We demanded life drawing again, strangely enough, as a group, independently. It wasn't as if it was discussed. We just demanded it where previously they'd thrown all the plaster casts out. You know, the 70s was this rebellion against tradition and it was all colour field, and which was fine. It was a bunch of artists rebelling against their training. Fantastic. They had the training. And then a whole group of artists didn't get the training.
Mm.
And then it's sort of kind of a bit of a dead spot in the art world. And then, you know, we were told very few of you will be successful. Out of the group of people that went through art school, there are so many names that have gone on to do and continue to do great work.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting.
What do you guys do for your well-being or physical self too? Because obviously creativity is a lot in your head too, isn't it? I know it's physical, hand and eye.
Yeah. Mm.
But it's the, you know, I find if I don't exercise for long periods of time, I'm feral.
Yeah, no. you need it for your emotional landscape, don't you?
Yeah.
I find swimming really. Swimming and walking and yoga.
And I love surfing, so.
Yeah. Well, all those things work really, really well. I think that I love it when you Bondi or you guys live in Bronte, up the coast in Avalon and stuff. Seeing people surf every day is a ritual. And I talked to the guys and said they do it for their – you think they're doing it to have some fun, but they're actually doing it mostly for their mental health.
Yeah, meditation and a calming of the spirit, although it gets a bit aggressive this time. There's a few too many surfers these days, but now and again you can jag a nice little, you know, quiet time and have a good little surf in Sydney still.
Yeah.
The beauty of living in Sydney, that we're able to do all this.
Spectacular, isn't it?
I mean, it's an incredible city.
Very lucky to live in this city.
There's so many incredible beaches along the coast.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned your daughter Camille before. I guess she had no choice but to be a creative.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she's
a bit like you.
Maybe our genetics.
It was one of those things too. She was where she really excelled as well.
She always did well creatively.
She did, and she just
and the encouragement.
Was she rubbish at school? Did you guys say, "Don't worry"?
No, she surprised. She was really good at school as well.
Oh, yeah.
which shocked me.
She was really good at languages, and I think it's all those. She was very good at Japanese, which was
very
surprising.
Very good at writing and spelling. Well, I constantly ask her how to spell words. I love it.
But all those, we did a lot of work in Japan for a while in Tokyo, and I think all that time
she
pushing her in a pram, and I think she got this very natural ear for Japanese, so she speaks really great.
Wow.
Japanese.
That's not an easy language.
No, it's really.
She's really good at it too.
Yeah, sometimes when we've been in Tokyo,
she still studies it.
She translates for us.
Yeah, she still studies it, which is great.
And with her artwork. Have you guys coached her on that, or she just found her way with that?
She's really found her own way. We didn't give her direction. She finds her own direction. We will comment on the work that she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing a lot of portraiture, and she said, I'm really interested in sort of the culture that I'm living in and the community of friends that I have and the diversity of them. And so she often will come home and she's got some crazy guy sitting in the studio.
Yeah, and she's done...
She's, you know, painting.
And it's not her dad.
And it's not her dad. Yeah.
No. She did me a lot when she was young. mad scribbles with dad written underneath.
No, but she just loves fashion. There, so she loves, and this is maybe, she also loves the fashion of the portraiture too, and creating around the portraiture and some of the people that she finds interesting visually and their creativity. She loves painting that.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I've seen some of her work. It's beautiful. And it's interesting how it's just so different to your guys' work. It's I think that she's obviously finding her voice, and she's incredibly young, so I suppose she's got a long way to go.
Yeah.
What's the future look like? Or do you guys think that far ahead, or are you just focusing on keep doing what you're doing?
We're really in the moment. We just keep working and keep... Mm. I mean, seeds get planted and things are emerging, but just ultimately for us, it's about the work.
Yeah, I'd say a year gets pretty mapped out. Maybe exhibition-wise, you can get a couple of years mapped out.
Yeah.
But living in the moment and allowing time for opportunities that arise as well. You don't want to be saying no to things that are really good, but you've got no time to do.
Mm.
So you've got to leave space.
We do struggle a little bit with time, though, with everything that gets laid on. So that's, yeah.
A lot of things you talked about today are applicable to anybody in life, not just creative people.
Mm. Sure.
And I think that we're talking about kind of getting stuck and finding a way of kind of, you know, finding the flow, etc. I guess doing what you believe in, what you love.
That's very helpful.
It's so, yeah, you guys have found that from really early on. Some people will find it the week before they pass away or never find it or change careers several times through their lives and still not find it. How is the best way to find what you love?
I don't think there's a particular avenue you can suggest. It's just...
Follow what you love doing.
Yeah, if you love doing something. But some people, you know...
Pursue it.
They have even trouble loving what they're doing or where they're living or, you know... I think fear is an underlying factor in a lot of...
Mm-hmm.
People are afraid to do that because, you know, they won't have this, I won't be able to achieve that. Oh, I'm not good enough, you know, but I'd love to do that. And so, but this and this, inevitably there's a fear sitting under a lot of people's decisions. And I can't suggest how to get over that other than I equate it to surfing. Sometimes, you know, you've been out on a big day and there's a big wave coming at you and you've got to make a decision. Do I paddle over it or do I go? And inevitably I've tended to think I'm going. And then you turn around and face the consequences of that decision, which quite often are brutal. and I have gone on a number of times when it has been a very poor decision. But also you learn in that space and you learn when to make that decision and then you start to get better at that. Mm-hmm. And I think you've just got to dive in and go.
Just go for it.
And don't make excuses.
Yeah.
Because the excuses... Are you that passionate about it, really?
Yeah. It's something that, you know, when you love something, it just takes you over, doesn't it?
Mm,
so you've got to find that thing. And once you know, whether it's you know, cooking or whatever it may be, but you got to have that love, don't you?
Yeah. Well, and also, I guess keeping busy. I know that I'm good if I keep busy.
Yeah, same.
Project after project after project. If I have any kind of too long a period of nothing going on, I start eating my own brain. You know, I try to solve everything else.
But as an artist, there's always something, even in, you know, quiet down times, you know, that you're thinking about something, or mm-hmm. you've got your sketchbook there and you're just going through some ideas, or you're reading up on something that you're interested in. So there's always something ticking away.
Where does inspiration come from, like, for both of you? Is it nature, or is it just thinking and sketching?
Just life experiences,
yeah,
I think.
I mean, nature is obviously a huge one for me, but...
Yeah, same.
And just life push and pull and tides and... Yeah, it's but nature is really this never-ending discovery.
Yeah. And it's being amongst nature is important, isn't it?
It is, and that's what I love about my studio at Hidden Lake.
Yeah.
It's right on the lake, and it's just in the willow trees, and it's quiet, and there's just hear nature. And that's easier for the friends on the other side to come in.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. the reassuring friends.
Yes.
Give you a hug.
Yeah.
I noticed that during COVID, just that, so we're still talking about COVID, but it was a real game changer for a lot of people, including myself, just kind of that alone time, that thinking time, that quiet time.
It was so quiet. That was the amazing thing about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, going to a shop, there's no one there.
And once you got over that...
It was almost like, you know, you're the last person on earth. Yeah. It kind of... There were moments where you felt... you know, I could luckily travel to the studio. It was close enough to where we live. And there's no cars on the road. There's no one around.
No planes in the sky.
No planes. It was so
eerie. We were lucky
during
that time we were able to keep working and keep manufacturing and keep making at the studio, that our studio wasn't shut down.
We could keep
And so that
open.
We were able to fulfill our overseas, because our online business just took off.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And then we also were working with Net-a-Porter and Matches, and we were able to sort of keep going.
To deliver and keep everyone in a job, and everyone was coming to work. And we were a perfect workspace, especially our manufacturing, for COVID, because everyone wears masks. So there's constant, you know, everyone's in a mask, and it's better than any mask, you know, anyone's going to buy at a chemist. This
is
proper industrial, you know, equipment. So it was the safest place for people to come.
Wow.
Anyway.
I mean, congratulations on what you guys have achieved and continue to achieve, and actually you think about all the other people around you that you've, you know, helped kind of have a career and a place to work, and doing phenomenal projects as well, like, and the joy that you bring in your artwork to the world and to people, you know, their homes, etc.
Thank you, Vince. And you too. And you too. I mean, God.
Well, you continue.
You continue as well. And giving. Oh. I mean, just looking at your studio here, wow. A hive of activity happening here.
It's fun, isn't it? It's fun having a place, a physical place where people can kind of come and play and discuss ideas, try things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and again,
you build a community here.
A creative space, which is something that, you know, we very much love and want to, you know, people to come and work for us. We want them to really enjoy working for us.
We want, happy workspaces.
Yeah.
I see that picture. There's a several pictures that you always shot in your... studio at
Redfern,
and it's just kind of, it's got, I mean, I got a lot of stuff on my walls, but a lot of shit on my walls here, but printouts and stuff, but you got cards, you got objects, look at that, God, I'm looking at all the different things, and that kind of magpie approach to kind of finding things and bringing it into your world.
So much inspiration, where it's a photograph of a piece of coral, or it is a piece of coral, or, you know, it's an old master's painting, or, you know, there's so much beauty in this world to be discovered.
Yeah, sometimes I have to clear it up sometimes and re-edit it.
It gets a bit out of control.
It gets out of control where you start to
lose it.
It's
kind of nice.
And so you need to sort of re-edit, but it's great.
There's something in that too. Around, I had Sabella Court on the other day, and she was really fascinated by and studied history, and, you know, really interested in the past and how you might bring that into the current world. Is that we talked about, I think, if I remember correctly, it was only a week ago, but talking about, like, the confidence in collecting, or you know, like how people's homes are kind of have makeovers, and it's not about them. It's just about someone's decision on what goes in it, what doesn't go in it, what does it look like, what color it is. It's something I find really hard to comprehend, because I have to kind of create my own space, and I make the light right and the composition and things like that. But I wonder what a world feels like when it's not, when you haven't curated or accumulated things that you find precious or value. You know, that you're living in a kind of a clinical kind of situation.
Yeah.
You might cut this bit out.
Maybe it's when you walk into a hotel room, and does it talk to you or does it not talk to you? It's like that.
We're not staying here.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what I
do. Don't unpack.
Yeah. Don't unpack.
No, I walk into every hotel. I walk in and just sit on the chair and look at Louise.
No, I can't bear.
Oh. And just wait. And
it's gonna be right. You're only here for a couple of days, or you know, you're gonna make it a great experience. But
it's like buying a coffee that just, you know, that your one coffee of the day. You go,
it's got to be good. Yeah, when it's not good, it's annoying. It's got to be good.
Yeah. It's got to be.
But I think your home
is the whole experience, and I think that your life is so enriched by where you live.
And it's your chance to be creative. Is build your own home and your furnishings and your choices.
Yeah.
And then they have a real.
It stimulates your creative juices too.
You know, they can choose a rug that we've designed. But it's their decision. It's their creative moment, putting that rug on the floor, moving it with the, you know, how it's going to work in with everything else.
Yeah.
I love the fact that, you know, you bring out people's creativity when they buy a necklace or a bowl.
Yeah.
And those creative decisions about where do we put this.
That is creativity right there. And sometimes people have come up to me and said, I can't leave home unless I've got this necklace on. And it's sort
that's
of
nice.
That's now become who they are. It's no longer ours, it's now theirs, and they totally own it.
It's those things in life that you find that are now part of your life, probably forever.
Yeah, things you just look at and love every time. Yeah.
You guys have been amazing, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today. One more question I'm going to ask. Being so focused on design creativity, I wonder if you guys feel that you've designed your life.
Inadvertently, yes. I don't think it's been a work in but it is a work in progress, just by the act of doing.
Yeah, I think it sort of takes care of itself again. You know, it's like the idea of style. I remember my dad telling me this story about Degas, and this woman and her little son came up and said, "Hi, Degas, I just want to tell you this is my son. And the wonderful thing about him is that he's found his style." And Degas said to the mother, "Well, that's good, because I haven't found mine."
In other words, it's just,
you know, you want to be more flexible than that, and be open to the world.
Yeah.
You don't want to be too fixed. It's nice to be, you know, we obviously have things that we love and have a certain feeling for certain things, but also, you know, we can change and be open to change.
You need to be plastic. Change is really important. You need to be plastic and allow flexibility into and not rigid and caught up in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But it's nice to have a certain philosophy, isn't it?
Mm.
And things accumulate from everything that we learn and sort of
keep learning.
And keep learning.
Mm.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Vince.
Thank you, Vince. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Design Your Life with Dinosaur Design founders and powerhouse couple Louise Olsen and Stephen Ormandy. Tune into the next episode where I catch up with the legendary British designers and another icon couple, Sir John Searle and Lady Frances Searle. Thanks for listening to this episode of Design Your Life. If you'd like to find out more about how you can design your life, head to the website at designyourlife.com.au. If you found this episode inspiring, please don't forget to review and subscribe. If you have any ideas or like to get in touch, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email at hello@frostcollective.com.au.